Hoe geef je richting aan verandering? Hoe maak je impact met visie, leiderschap en innovatie? Je hoort het op het podcastkanaal New Business Radio. Listen today, lead tomorrow. Hier vind je al onze programma's voor business shapers. Met gesprekken met leiders, ondernemers en vernieuwers die hun organisatie klaarmaken voor de volgende sprong. Check je favoriete podcastplatform en abonneer je op New Business Radio. Listen today, lead tomorrow. Hoe ontketen je de kracht van mensen in organisaties? PeoplePower brengt je de laatste wetenschappelijke inzichten en praktijkvoorbeelden. Over leiderschap en leren, betrokkenheid en bevlogenheid, inzetbaarheid en inclusie. Omdat mensen het verschil maken in jouw organisatie. PeoplePower met Glenn van der Burg.
For far too long, learning was focused on providing people with more and more knowledge. However, learning was not designed to apply the knowledge in a fast-changing work context. In an ideal world, we would be training only when our work asks for more knowledge or new skills. That's why we invited Bob Mosher to talk about the 5 moments of need framework. How can we use it for lifelong learning? As I said, our guest is Bob Mosher. He is an award-winning expert on learning and development, author of 2 books, and co-founder of strategic consulting firm Apply Synergies. And my co-host is Tom Bos, Managing Director of Online Academy. Thank you for listening to PeoplePower. And of course, welcome to Bob Mosher and Tom Bos. Great to have you. Of course, Bob, you're far, far away on the other side of the ocean. But technology enables us to have a normal conversation together. Great to have you on the show. Tom, great to have you on the show. It was actually your idea, Tom, to ask Bob to be on our show. Why is that? Why did you want to talk to Bob?
Yeah, well, that's as you said, it's because of the theory, the 5 moments of need. And as I explained to Bob, we speak about lifelong learning in every episode. And this time around, it's about like, how can we apply the 5 moments of need to lifelong learning? And is there like any distinguished investment in one of the 5 moments needed, for example, to facilitate in lifelong learning? Yeah. And Bob has a very, we should talk about it for a bit, but I find it a very easy to understand framework and easy to talk about. So that's the reason I thought, let's have a chat with Bob.
So we'll dive into, of course, the framework. But first, Bob, if you look at the personal way that you give shape to a lifelong learning in your life, how do you do that?
Well, thanks, friends. And I'm honored to be here. Yeah, my gosh, it's funny. I think every L&D professional is a lifelong learner. You know, and so it's the 5 moments of need. What I love about the framework, like Tom just mentioned a moment ago, is that I have found it personally as powerful in my own life as I have in my work. And so it really does shift me to understand that, you know, I think COVID, to be honest, the world that we've lived in has broken down some barriers of how we traditionally look at when, particularly in the corporate side of our life and our professional development, when learning occurs. It's not 9 to 5 anymore, if it ever was. And so I really think that this has challenged me and others to realize that if we're going to be current in a world that is churning like never before, both personally and professionally, that we really have to adopt a more, you know, ongoing, and I love your program, a lifelong learning look at how we look at things.
Yeah. So, and how do you shape that in your probably very busy life?
Well, you know, that the world of change is ridiculous right now. You know, it's funny. I think in my own life, I'm a grandpa. I have 2 brilliant, wonderful, obviously I'm not biased at all, grandchildren, and a family of 3 wonderful kids who've tolerated me for all of their lifetime, and my life partner, my wife, of almost 40 years. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, as you get older, you know, you realize how little you know. And you know, when I talked to my kids, and of course took them through their teenage years, and I went through my own, you know, you sort of reach this bizarre feeling that you know it all, or that you know what you need to know, right? Mm-hmm. And so as I've gotten older, and learned more. You know, as a dear colleague of mine once said, you know, the more I know and the more I become an expert, the less of an expert I feel. And so, you know, constantly keeping up with what's going on in the world, what's going on in my family, what's going on in my life, and particularly what's going on in the world of learning nowadays has kept me on my toes and requires, you know, a fresh look at how I perform every day as a learner in all the roles in my life, personal and professional.
And can you make that concrete for me? So let's take a normal day in the life of Bob Mosher. What can I see you do? Do you have specific times that you read a book or listen to a podcast?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, you know, it's been a re-regimen of new habits, right? I spend probably 20% of my day on social media, both personally and professionally, to be honest.
20?
I spent a good amount of time in LinkedIn. And other areas, very active in Facebook, to be mm-hmm. honest, and Instagram and some of those others. Mm-hmm. Because I think the freshness and the immediacy of that medium is really amazing to me. And again, it spans my life, both professionally and personally, to know how friends are feeling and families are going and trends are happening in both our world and in L&D. Right. The other side of that is I also make time to read. You know, I you know, books. You know, I don't know if anyone this podcast remembers books, but you know, spending time remaining fresh. I try to always have a professional book of some kind on my nightstand.
What are you reading right now?
I'm reading one around happiness of all things, the power of happiness in our lives, both personally and professionally, and it's actually a business book that takes a slant on the power of being happy. And if I may, you know, obviously we've gone through a rough 24 months or more, right? Mm-hmm. And so that has weighed on all of us emotionally as well as professionally. So that's my current read, and I manage a company. I have employees, and I care for their well-being and their happiness, both at work and outside. So that's my current point of study when nice. It comes to that part of things.
All right, let's dive into the five moments of need for our listeners that are not aware of this theory of yours and your colleague, I guess. Can you take us through the five moments of need? What kind of framework is it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was born out of those L&D folks on this call or on this program will remember the days of blended learning, and we still call things that. And I had come out of a rather failed effort at that. We had done all of the blended learning things, but we weren't getting blended learning results. We weren't getting application. And it was back in a time when I was a senior director at Microsoft. And so I brought this brilliant man, Dr. Con Gottfredson, into my building. I had known him as a colleague, and now he's my business partner in Apply Synergies. And Con took a look at our program. And what he basically said was, you know, this is a brilliant content blend, but it's not a great context blend. And I was like, well, wait. What does that mean? What's the difference? And he said, well, too often we design learning. I loved your lead in from a knowledge perspective. I would call that a content view. We want to be sure we cover everything, or our subject matter experts, SMEs, are sure that everything is in the course, right? And so Khan said, well, the reality is that that's really our view of what we think we have to produce, but the learner comes at learning every day, lifelong learning every day, from a context of need. What do they need to perform that day? And he showed me for the first time, this is well over 20 years ago, the five moments of need, and I have not looked back since, and it challenged my view of design from that moment. And they are, the first two are familiar. You'll all know these well, and L&D knows them really well, and that is when someone doesn't know anything. They come to a topic or a subject with no background, no context whatsoever. That is the moment of new, when something is brand new to us. So I have a need to understand and ultimately perform or transfer new things.
Right.
The second need is more. So, you know, once I have a base of a course or, you know, level one or whatever we call it, introduction, there's always more. So how do we design an experience that builds on base knowledge, but allows people to bring on more information?
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are, I'm sorry.
No, I said okay.
Okay.
I'm just encouraging you.
Yeah. So, friends, those are traditionally best met by training. And it's interesting because sometimes I am labeled as the training hater guy or the classroom hater guy. I want to be sure I clarify here. It's not that I feel that way at all. If anything, I feel that the classroom, which and e-learning and anything that's really knowledge or event based, be it digital or in person, does a wonderful job at addressing those two moments. But here's the problem, friends. Learners don't spend a majority of their time in those two moments. They spend the majority of their time trying to apply what they think they know or should know every day. That's moment three.
Right.
They're trying to keep up with change, particularly in the world we live in today. So I knew the rules yesterday and I'm performing well yesterday, but now things are different. Yeah. And then the last, of course, is when I get in trouble, solve. When I find myself in an area where I think I know what I'm doing and I wander down a path, but I misstep. And so how do we as learning professionals in lifelong learning address all five moments of need when we traditionally have met one, which again is new and more, one and two, three is apply, four is change, and five is solve.
Right.
And what I like about the framework is that it's connected to the need of the learner.
Yes.
And one of the biggest problems that Tom and I encounter with all our studio guests is that all the content is there. All the tools are there. The only thing that we have a problem with is getting people enthusiastic and motivated to actually do something.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your friends, I'd actually push back, if I may, on a word you use, my friend, and that is that, and I don't know if this translates well, but, you know, I've always challenged the difference between motivation and inspiration. Mm-hmm. You know, motivation tends to be, if you look it up, it tends to be an extrinsic thing. I used to get asked this all the time when I taught train the trainer classes. How, as a good trainer, how do I motivate my learners to care?
Right. Yeah.
Well, the problem with the context of the question is that that means it's our job to inflict this on them.
It's a need of the trainer as opposed to the need
of
the user. Yeah, yeah.
And the content and the design of the content and the stories we tell and the metaphors we use and the examples we show. Well, and again, I'm not dispelling those. And there are times I've used those in a moment one or two time. But when a learner moves into apply, change, and solve, friends, they are now inspired, intrinsically motivated to not lose their job, to get better at what they do, to not fail or be embarrassed or just, you know, fail in general. When we move into those things, how do we create a learning environment that allows an inspired learner who has intrinsically driven needs to get to, I love your point, that information, 2 clicks, 10 seconds, as quickly as they can?
Yeah.
Is that the rule? 2 clicks, 10 seconds?
It is. It is. And Glenn, it's funny. When I first tried to design for it, it was a challenge because I was vested heavily in e-learning at the time. And it's not 2 clicks, 10 seconds half the time. Mainly because you got to get to it through an LMS half the time.
Right.
There's 5 clicks right there, right? So.
Worse, you have to enroll in a training, which is in 3 months' time. We have a slot for you.
Yeah, it's still two clicks, painful. But then it takes you a month.
Yeah, two clicks, so 3 months waiting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I guess what's interesting about that is what we have to look at. My mom was a lifelong teacher in public school here in the States. And she said, you know, our job as educators is to create an enabled, impassioned learner. And your scenario you just described to me is a passive one, right? We have these scenarios and situations and time frames and you know, learning paths and such that whether we realize it or not, we are teaching learners to wait for us. And so even though they have a need tomorrow to use their LCMS or, you know, or their whatever, you know, we say, we'll help you with that in June.
Yeah.
Because that's when the next course is. So to your point of lifelong learning, my gosh, that to me feels as contrary to that as it, we could possibly be.
Yeah, and the problem might be bigger with the like the third, fourth, and fifth moment of need, right? Like the time.
Oh my God.
Time to start is getting problematic.
Yeah, well, I mean, friends, look at COVID. I mean, really, how can we not ignore the elephant in the room, right? And so, you know, there was talk about a world that has changed our learners, I think, forever, whether they realize it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk to them quite a bit. I think we need to talk to them more. And what they're telling me, though it hasn't been fun, it's a terrible word, or enjoyable, or any of those things, they've survived. I mean, they've for the most part, they've gotten through it, right? And yeah. So the question becomes, what skills have they learned in doing that? And I would argue, knowingly or not, they've emerged much less risk averse, much more courageous, much more demanding of immediacy and things that help them at their moments of need than they were when we started. So as L&D professionals, how are we going to meet, when we emerge from this, hopefully, how are we going to meet that learner where they are? Are we going to go back to classes and schedules and brick and mortar rooms or virtual versions of that? Or are we going to try to do a different approach?
Yeah, and you could even say that because the situation so dramatically changed for everybody and everybody had to cope with working from home, using Teams or Zoom or whatever, and managing their own work, not having a boss near, just telling you what to do. There was a tremendous amount of learning going on, and there was not a learning professional there to assist.
Right.
Yes.
So do we even need them?
Well, it's a great question, right? I mean, do we need them the way we used to?
Or do we need more crises? Let's hope not. As long as they're not health crises.
I would never wish this on them again. But at the same time, I think you are, again, speaking to what we as L&D professionals have to address. What are we now? How are we needed now? What kind of solutions do we need and can we build now that we may not have been allowed to, frankly, or, you know, because of the world we were in, we didn't. So that's what excites me more than anything right now, is that I think the door is open with a receptive learner and even a buyer of what we do. But I think their patience for us will be short-lived in how we respond to the way they want us to help them now.
Right.
And if you look at lifelong learning, Bob, how can the five moments of need help us in solving that huge problem of the world changing so fast, us having to make maybe three or four career changes, and even more job changes in our career?
Mm. Well, you know, I think it starts with tools, right? We enable people with tools, and I use the tool broadly here. It can be a class, it could be a website, it could be a peer, it could be a EPSS and electronic performance support system. It could be a job aid. You know, those to me are the tools of learning. And so what I think, Glenn, we have to look at is, when we emerge from this, is what is our new toolkit for this? And when it comes to lifelong learning and understanding the five moments of need, I think we have to start building for apply ahead of new and more.
Okay.
You know, that was a remarkable pivot for me 10 years ago when I started doing this exclusively in my work. And what I realized really quickly, and I think all the L&D folks out there have to listen to this, is we knowingly or not, have become very conditioned with how we think and what we build. And even though I was very astute at this, I wrote a book on it with my colleague and so on, you know, I always tell the story that when we were asked to teach our first workshop on workflow learning in five moments, we built a workshop with no help, no EPSS, no workflow tools. And it really put us back on our heels, because we're like, oh my gosh, we wrote the book on this like a month ago. And when we were asked to do a workshop on it, a live event, we we went right back to what we knew and forgot what we had learned. So I think for lifelong learning, and you, I think you coined it perfectly earlier, how do we tame the madness? How do we create an environment that learners can self-teach, self-remediate, and go to training only when they have to or it's necessary? That's a complete flip from how we looked at this 24 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so then I wonder, like, who should be creating this stuff? Because like lifelong learning generally implies that it's not your employer, or at least not only your employer.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look what we're doing today, right? I mean, you guys, again, I think it's all in how we look at this stuff. And I just came back from a conference, my first one in 2 years, and it really, in some ways, disheartened me, because it was a L&D conference, a small one, but you could tell that the L&D folks in the room were just so happy we were back where we used to be, we were all together talking about the same stuff that we talked.
It was like a school reunion.
Oh my gosh, you guys, I couldn't help but sit there going, is anyone else not see that the emperor has no clothes here? I mean, how are we having the same conversation with the world that we just drove here or flew here from? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I really think that we have to realize, to the point you made a bit ago, is that learners created some remarkable assets, learning and support assets during this. They did. We didn't. Mm-hmm. And so what if we took a step back and did some analysis through the lens of the five moments and did some digging and data mining into what our learners made, from the stickies that surround their monitors to, you know, whatever they made. And what if we became the content aggregators rather than the content creators? I think we'd find that there's a remarkable wealth of moment of need, workflow design tools out there, but they're just not being well aggregated, right? And so how do we enable these wonderful assets that should remain in the hands of those who made them, and rather we help with the effective 2 clicks, 10 seconds aggregation of those things? Now, governance comes into play here, friends, in a remarkable way. And that's a word I hadn't used the first 20 years of my career. You know, once we start opening, the moment I went head deep into the five moments in workflow learning, the first thing I realized was I ain't going to make all this stuff anymore. In fact, I'm going to make very little of it. So how do I get my arms around, because it's made by those who are doing the work, and it should, but how do I help with the currency of that? The governance of that, the frequency with which something should or should not be kept current. These kinds of questions, you know, are very different than we're used to addressing.
It's kind of what you are doing, Tom, with Online Academy.
Yeah, except for that, obviously, like in this case, you would use resources from anyone around the world who created something. Yeah. So what we generally try to add to the equation is not is like the knowledge is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Usually, it's also it's broadly available, and it's also kind of learnable. But we try to improve the learnability of content.
I love that.
So that's you could see that as curation. It is especially adding didactics and like raising increasing effectiveness. For example, that's
yeah. I mean you. You know, your friends, we're working with a large government client right now here in the States, and we're in the middle of this aggregation world, because it's the content or the performance problem they brought to us is already being addressed randomly or sporadically or not consistently across the enterprise. So again, as opposed to saying, okay, well, let's write a 5-day course for that, what we've had to do instead is we've had to, and we're teaching this workshop more and more, is that we're teaching not SMEs, frankly, but those in the workflow who own this knowledge, how to structure it well,
right,
so that it's consumable by others. Yeah. So our workshops are not around the content, friends. Our workshops are around how to create consumable content and keep it current in an efficient, easy way. by those who are living it every day in the workflow.
Guess that's the only way to go, like in like the challenge to scale up learning to such a size that we have enough high quality resources available for the whole world to keep on learning, especially the later phases or like they're not necessarily higher needs maybe, but like level 3, 4, and 5. You would need much more content. You would need it much faster. It will change much faster, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't, as a, if we put all L&Ders together, we wouldn't be able to deliver anything useful, probably.
Well, I think for a lot of people, their learning system for lifelong learning is called YouTube.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
For me also, I mean, a few years ago, I built a room myself within my house. I used YouTube for that. I watched hours and hours of all these guys putting together drywall and how this all works.
Yeah.
I'm now improving. So I'm doing the more part of my need. I'm improving my guitar guitar playing skills. It's unbelievable what's everything that's out there. But there's also a lot of crappy stuff.
So, right. Well, see, and Glenn, you're onto something, right? So this gets back to my content aggregation, curation world, is that the danger here is that there's always been more content than we needed. I don't know why we didn't think, you know, since SharePoint came along, which was how many years ago, right? We in other internet repositories and now digital stuff, there's not a shortage of content. The problem is that they are twofold. Number one, there's a shortage of good content. How do we tame the madness of all the searches I hit on YouTube, half of which are junk or, you know, that's an extreme statement. But let's say, how about this? They're too advanced for me. They're too beginning for me. They're too long for me.
Right.
You know, they don't go enough into the thing I just want. They wander and, you know, all those things. So there's that. And then the second thing is accessibility. You know, how do we, every company we go into to help has not just a lot of content, they have it in a lot of places. So how do we help with the accessibility, the 2 clicks, 10 seconds side of this, so that the learner doesn't get frustrated and click out? You know, what we learned very early in our work when it comes to moments 3 through 5 is that when I'm at work faced with a problem, my patience for learning is very low, and my tolerance for a lot of stuff is very low. So we have to be sure that we, pull back on that and make that journey to the right asset at the right time as efficient and effective as we can.
Right. Yeah.
And I can imagine, Bob, if you zoom in on the apply side or zoom in on the solve side, then you have the intrinsic motivation to learn something because you just need it for your performance or you need it to solve something. If you look at the lifelong learning, you most of the times you do not know yet what you have to learn because the shift within the labor market or within your your job is so big. So how do we cope with that?
Well, this goes back to a word I've been using over and over again, and that's an analysis of the workflow. That's the context, at least on the professional side of our life, that we have. And L&D does a really bad job of understanding that. We get SMEs in a room, we have to do a leadership class, and we say, okay, tell us everything that a leader needs to know. And then off they go, right? And here's the problem with that analysis out of the chute, is that we skipped an important part or an important question, which is not what does a leader need to know, but when do they need to know it? What is the context of leading? And until we understand that, then the question that follows, which is, okay, then what do we need to know to support that, becomes a lot more finite and focused. And so in the world that we live in today, our ability to do what we call, this is our words, but we call something called rapid workflow analysis. And rapid is an important word to your question, Glenn, because it's got to be, if it's not rapid, we can't keep up. So how do we continue?
Because it's ever changing.
Yeah, exactly. So if we have to, and if we go back to adding task analysis or the things that we used to do before that takes days and weeks and so on, we can, and by the way, again, I'm not knocking that approach, but we don't live in that world anymore, I would argue. And so we have to have a way that we identify the workflow initially, I'm going to emphasize that word, but then have a way of keeping up with it when it changes. And in many organizations, professions, look at the medical field right now, it's changing hourly. So as a dear friend of mine said, we can't train our way out of that problem. We have to have a different view of right. how we get people and keep them current.
Right.
Yeah, and I can imagine that you have to have a very sharp look at the context that is changing
yes.
and ever changing.
Yes.
I can also imagine that there's something bigger than that. It's something that's just not in scope of the learner that they do not yet see, but other people do see, like mm-hmm. maybe the influence of AI or some new technology mm-hmm. that almost nobody knows, but will have an impact in 2 or 3 years on the whole professions. So how do we incorporate that knowledge of the changing environment on what we have to learn in a lifelong learning perspective?
Well, I think it gets back to your question you asked me earlier, which is we have to eat our own dog food here, as we used to say sometime in the States, right? Which means we have to be lifelong learners in the trade that we are in. It really sometimes frustrates me, if I may say this, at 61 years old, I'm in my 61st year around the sun here, and I have to tell you that sometimes I get frustrated with our profession because we. You know, and I get it, you guys. I've been at this for almost 40 years. I'm in my 39th year of learning and development, and I've worked hard at it, and so I get the pedigree, and I get the honoring of what's gotten us here. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I have a dear friend who's a doctor, and he's like, look, if I took the approach to medicine like you do to learning, I'd still be putting leeches on people half the time. And, you know, he goes, I can't get you people to budge. I still go to the same boring class, the same square classroom, the same professor I had back when I was, you know, trying to become a doctor. And he goes, and by the way, I'm not knocking that individual or the intent. What I'm knocking is real. I mean, we haven't moved beyond that. Now, and so, you know, how do we keep our eye on AI? How do we keep our eye on the outliers that are not even in L&D? I mean, YouTube, look, right? That wasn't created for learning. I mean, like L&D. And so, but look what it's become in the scenario, Glenn, you just described. How do we embrace those mm-hmm. in what we do? And at the same time, this is hard for us to do, dare I say, how do we let go of things that frankly just don't work anymore?
And like, give an example, what should we stop tomorrow?
Oh, this is going to get me some hate mail. But
then it's probably juicy stuff. So
here's the thing. Boy, wait till you hear this one, you guys. I think we have to redefine what we mean by a subject matter expert. You know, I want to be awful careful here because I love these people and I would not have gotten through the first 25-ish years of my career without them. But the SME of the old days is not the SME of today. We have to look at, if we want contextual, what's happening in the workflow, you know, keeping up with change and so on. The danger of an SME, the way we used to define them and the way we use them, is these are people who have arrived. Mm-hmm. They are not new learners anymore. They're yeah. in fact, they're anything but that. I saw a recent study that said up to 70% of what a new person needs to know, an SME has forgotten because it's become innate to them. They don't even think to do, right? And I can't tell you guys how many workflow analysis I go into where we have an SME in the room. I think they still play a valuable role, but we have a lot of non-SMEs in there by our current definition of them. Mm-hmm. People who are just doing the job, people who are new to the job, people who manage people who do the job. And the interesting back and forth that always emerges is that inevitably, especially the newbie in the room, right? The person who really is our audience, frankly, when they listen to the SME talk, they're like, you know what? You're brilliant, and I really hope someday I can be you. But half the stuff you're saying should be in this course. I'm not even remotely ready to learn or care about or do.
Right.
Right. So that to me, friends, is the first pivot. Yeah. You know, if we're gonna meet the five moments of need today, we have to have fundamentally in the room those who are living the five moments in the world we live in today, not the one we used to try to aspire to.
Yeah, yeah. So the subject matter expert has the curse of knowledge. They know too much.
Yeah.
And because they know too much, they forget the first steps that they themselves also have taken, but it was so long ago that they can't remember what their first successful steps were.
Glenn, how's about this one? And I can't tell how many SMEs are unconsciously incompetent about certain things. You know, they many of them. I had a recent example. I obviously say the company or stuff, but we had senior salespeople, you know, SVPs of sales, mm-hmm. in the room, and they wanted to inflict their new sales stuff on people in the field. Well, when we brought people from the field in and got in the room to discuss what the workflow of sales is like, not the sales process that they want the CRM to follow or blah, 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 blah. What we instantly got to was the SMEs who frankly had been promoted out of the field were like, oh my gosh, you mean you don't do that anymore? Oh wait, you mean you don't have that problem any longer? Uh-huh. Or you have a technology now that does that for you? I used to have to do that by hand all the time. You know, so the SME, you know, had moved out of the context of the work because they were promoted out of doing. And so, right, there's the unconsciously incompetent part, and then there's the, you know, the reflexive, they don't think to do anymore part. And those two things together in the world we live in today are a dangerous view alone to have for our work.
So you would say it's better to have a group of people that do not know, and together with them start exploring and by that way start learning, than getting somebody in who already knows.
Yes. Yes, we put two people in a room, my friend. We put what I apologize, but these are our terms, but we have to call them something, right? So we have an SME in the room, subject matter expert, but we always have what we call a business matter expert in the room, a BME. And we tend to have more BMEs than SMEs. And the BME is a fancy way of saying those that may not know, but are doing the work, those that are, right? And so, and the reason why we want them to outnumber the SME is because in the end, the BME has to win. The BME has to win the discussion. So the SME is there for balance. I get it. And we do want BMEs to be SMEs, but we need to know the context of the workflow and the moments of need though the BME is experiencing to get them to the SME part. And like you said, Glenn, a moment ago, the SMEs fill in the blanks. You know, they put in things that the BME wouldn't know, but the balance of power, if you will, in the room, or the sheer amount of content that you end up teaching is exponentially smaller than it used to be.
Yeah. Tom, we have about 10 minutes left. Uh-huh. I want to make them count.
Oh my
gosh. What do you think should be the next 10 minutes? What should be the subject? What do you want to know from Bob?
let me take a sidestep first, if that's okay, because
please.
Bob made me think about the teachers, because I see the same problem there as you see, as Bob describes with subject matter experts, that they've moved out of the field. I'm not sure if they got promoted, but they generally moved out of the field or never were in the field in the first place and teach marketing, for example, or sales or whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
And especially in my field of work, which is reskilling and upskilling, like aside from initial education, you notice that there's a lot of teachers, luckily not in our business, but there's a lot of teachers who just teach. And I think that moves you out of the field so much. That, I don't know. Bob made me think about it. Like that's really inconvenient, because you get the same problem as with the SMEs, that they have a general understanding of what the work used to be, and especially for marketing or I don't know, chemical engineering or whatever, programming, there's so much change that their knowledge becomes obsolete very, very fast. They need to be skilling, not necessarily just teaching, which the yes. pandemic also got us, like got us educating people, like educators. They also needed to change their behavior, teach online, teach in different ways, but also like in the, wow, they have the most yeah. challenging job in the world, I guess. At the,
well. No, here, Tom, here would be my pivot for those folks, is that we inundated them with content so badly that we didn't give them a room to breathe or keep current. You know, I'm going to oversimplify the pivot, but when I talk to trainers, I'm like, look, if you're worth your salt and you really are in the job of training, you're not in the job of knowledge dissemination. You know, you're in the job of performance enablement. Mm-hmm. And if you like to sit in a podium and espouse to others what you know, then frankly, I don't really think you're a great trainer, frankly. But if your job is really to help those sitting in front of you go back and perform differently, better than they did when they came to you, you know, it becomes a teach to fish pivot, not feed a fish
right.
pivot. Yeah. And here's the thing, though, Tommy, you're spot on with this. It's a different skill. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an educational term in our world, in jargon, called metacognition, and scaffolding. And what these methods allude to is that the tip of the sword is helping people catch their next fish, not feed them one so they're full mm-hmm. in the moment. Right. And so what this allows you to do are two things. Number one is it lets you teach less, because if you're going to teach someone how to fish, they can catch their next fish on their own. They don't have to be shown every fish and fed every fish and the history of fish. You know, they right. And so what does that also do? Well, secondly, that frees the trainer up to have time to do other things like mentoring and coaching. Like going out in the field and remaining current in what's happening in the flow of work, not just when people take the time to come to them. It will give them time to build different assets, teaching to fish assets, not preparing fish to be cooked assets. And so it's a change. But what's exciting to me is with the many trainers I've spoken to, is what they'll tell you under their breath is this is what they wanted to do all along. I've had some trainers say that they hated the course they used to teach because they knew that they overwhelmed people by 9 o'clock and they overtaught content and nobody went back and applied half of their stuff.
Yeah,
it drove them crazy. This is a wonderful pivot in time for them to try something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my head, because I have to help people perform sometimes, so in the back of my head I'm already redesigning my whole program. So thanks for that in advance, Bob.
Yeah.
So maybe for the final part that we're going to talk about, I would like to know what you hope the L&D profession will look like in the future, Bob.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope that we are, you know, I've heard L&D people say for a long time, you know, I want a seat at the table. You know, I want to sit at the C-suite.
Yeah.
You know, having strategic conversations and being seen there as not just, you know, listening, but contributing strategically. You know, I want to move away from being an order taker. Too often, everything comes to me downstream. I'm not allowed to be involved up front. And so by the time people get to me, it's like, I want 5 days of training on leadership. And you go, well, wait, what? 5 days on leadership? Where did 5 days come from? And how do you know we even need leadership anything around here? But I'm not allowed to have that conversation because mm-hmm. by the time it gets to me, you know, it's baked.
Yeah.
And so my friend, where I want to see L&D do is, we have to move up earlier in the food chain. We have to understand the business better than we're allowed to in many cases. I get that, but also, if I may, looking myself in the mirror, then I have demanded I be allowed to be a part of. And so we have a remarkable opportunity coming out of COVID to take more of a business strategic leadership, enabling, performance-focused role than we were allowed to do before this started. But if we don't seize the day, if we don't adopt the five moments, at least from my perspective, or if we don't design for apply first, all the things we talked about in this hour, we're going to be put right back in that box.
Right.
Really, really fast.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like that it's time for rebranding learning and development to performance and development.
Yep. I mean, I'm a performance consultant. I am a performance consultant, or that's sometimes overused, and it also alludes to an earlier time of a different trade. But my favorite of late is being a performance architect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ah, nice.
You know, I architect scenarios where performance is enabled. I don't sit in front of a room bestowing that on others.
Right.
Right. And so, if I'm a performance architect, I should be allowed to ask different questions. I should be allowed to be involved in different scenarios than I have been. Huh. Right. This the rebranding, man, Glenn. You are, you know, are we L&D or are we P&D? Mm-hmm. Or are we L&P? Are we learning and performance? Right. But again, here's the problem, you guys. Branding means something. And the other day I was listening to an organization trying to have the conversation around this, and I counted how many times they said the word course, uh-huh, and how many times they said the word class and lesson and e-learn. And I was like, guys, if you want to have a different discussion, you have to have a different vocabulary. And you know, people aren't going to ask, as a dear friend of mine once said, people aren't going to buy red shirts if all they think you do is make blue pants. So,
yeah,
it's branding is, it starts with a mindset, and then we have to follow through with what we do.
Yeah, my closing off question would have been, how did we end up in that position as L&D in the first place? Like, why didn't they get involved in, why aren't they on C-level, for example? You kind of answered that question, but maybe you want to add a bit to
Yeah, well, here's the thing, you guys. If you look at the evolution of any business, right, from its beginning to its ending, is that somewhere along the line, you start reading your own press, and you start getting the scary part of the startup is this strive for normalcy and calm. Mm-hmm. The danger of normalcy and calm is that you're no longer innovative anymore. You know, you just want the water to be still and your classes to be full and your e-learnings to be, you know, clicked on and, you know, and I get it. I was in that world. I mean, but here's the thing. We settled there, Tom, for too long. And the world kind of passed us by. And we went from this, you know, got to have to a nice to have to, maybe we don't need you. So. You know, we've got to get back in the deep end here, and change the vocabulary. And it's painful. It has been painful for me in the last 15 years. I've been trying to do this on purpose.
Well, Bob, it was great talking to you. Of course, an hour is too short, but there's nothing keeping us back from trying to do it again sometime in the upcoming months.
That. Yeah, should love that.
That would be great. You've been listening to Bob Mosher from Apply Synergies. More information you can find on 5 Moments of Need, number5momentsofneed.com. And we'll also put it in, of course, in our show notes. So you can just click on it because you have only 2 clicks and 10 seconds. That's something I've learned.
Love
you
that.
Pick up quickly.
Love that.
And of course, you've also been listening to Tom Bos, Managing Director of Online Academy. And of course, thank you for listening to this episode of People Power.
Meer afleveringen vind je op peoplepower.radio en jouw favoriete podcast app.